Welcome to the Circle of the Panda podcast. For those of you that have been following our podcast over the years, you will know we had one called Soul Mind of Business. It hit a top 10 list, and so it was starting to boom right as I closed it out and went into Circle of the Panda. I love the branding of Circle of the Panda, and it gives us a broader range than that one did. But there were some episodes in there that were extraordinary. I learned a lot from, and we've got a lot of feedback from, and one was from Kyle Cummings. So this is an old episode, but listen in as Kyle talks about his journey. I mean, what to talk about turning things around and just having a great story that he can share with us. You're going to hear that one in this episode. And Kyle, if you're listening, I hope to get you back on a follow-up episode to just learn from you about what is going on these days. But for our listeners and viewers, listen and enjoy. This is a wonderful message from Kyle Cummings. Guest today on the Soul Mind and Business podcast is Kyle Cummings. Kyle, thank you so much for being a guest on the podcast.
My pleasure.
I must say, this is the shortest bit of research I've ever done in anybody on the podcast. Normally, I read a book or I look at a website or I talk to the guest in advance, but there's something that you said that I went, I just have to have him on the podcast. And it's something you wrote me about. And you said that you had an addiction, then you went to prison for the addiction, and then you recovered from it. And now one of your main purposes in life, maybe the main purpose in life, as you stated it, was to help people that are struggling with a similar addiction.
Yes, sir. Absolutely.
All right. So tell us about some of your past, as much as you want to go into it, as little. And also, what are you doing to help people in a similar situation?
So my past, I always just knew, like, as a young kid, like I had that desire for more. What life gave me just wasn't enough. I always sought more, and I don't know if that was a product of, my generation or, Western culture and the music videos I watched growing up. I don't know. I always wanted more, but I always use this analogy that was it's a really good depiction of like what my future entailed. And, in my neighborhood, we all had our bicycles and we would roam around the neighborhoods and ride our bikes and we'd watch like X Games and we'd want to emulate a lot of those extreme sports. And, so we were building a bike jump and I remember, we'd build it and I was like, oh, we get some, nice air off the jump and it was exciting and thrilling. And then we'd be like, well, okay, let's make it bigger. And so we'd make it bigger and then that would be fun and it'd be exhilarating. And then we'd, well, let's make it even bigger. And that was like a good representation of how I just wanted more. And, it wasn't just cool to hit that plateau of that, okay, the jump's getting a little big. That was a little scary. Let's leave it. No, what I would do is keep building that jump until inevitably I hurt myself. And that was that desire and that craving for more. And, it manifested later into drugs and alcohol. I actually grew up in a fairly healthy family network. My real father, my biological father, wasn't really in my life, but I was grateful enough to have my a stepfather that my mother married, and he was a very great man. And my mom was healthy and supportive, and we did butt heads because I think of that desire of, what life didn't give me was enough, what they didn't give me was enough, and we were kind of lower class too, so I had like insecurity issues and did a lot of comparing to others in my life. So insecurities were deep rooted at early age and manifested with that seeking more. So once I became in like middle school and early into high school is when I really started to experiment with drugs and finding where I was in life and where I connected, because that's what I was really seeking was sort of a connection, And so that's when it started off with just like marijuana, and then alcohol. And, I started skateboarding. I was still that extreme sport thrill. The adrenaline of that is always deep rooted in my life. Even to this day, I actually just went snowboarding on Saturday. And, so that hasn't died in me, but, I found my connection with people that did the same things I did. We skated, we would smoke pot, we would drink. And this is in high school. And this is where I found my acceptance and that's what mattered more than anything for me for a long time was my friends, more so than my family. And of course, by this time, I'm starting to get in trouble, and my parents are concerned, and grounding is, the go-to, but that didn't work. And, just rebel, rebel, rebel. And the consequences began to, pile up. In high school, I was, caught stealing from the school, and I was expelled, and I was actually on probation at the time. And I went to court for that charge, and my parents were at this time were pretty like pretty at I mean they're already at their wits' end, but by this time they're like really, really through. And I went in front of the judge, and they were about to release me to my parents' custody, and my mom said, "Your Honor, I'm not taking him home.
Oh.
I don't know what else to do. He doesn't listen to me. He doesn't do this." And so the judge had no other choice, but she took me into custody. So I went into a juvenile detention facility for 3 months. I went to a group home after that and was kind of putting my things back in order, but not for my mom, not for wanting to do good. It was because I missed my friends and I wanted to be back with my friends, and I completed that. And I actually made up my entire junior year in a few months at a charter school, and I was allowed to return to my high school and walk with my class, even though they had expelled me. But I had to like make a public apology to the whole school. And but they thought I had changed, and I did. I got to graduate, but I was, after parental rule ended, I turned 18. I got out on my own, and that's where things really just escalated to a new level. And other substances began making their entry into my life at this time, because again, I had to build the bike jump a little higher, right? The alcohol and the marijuana wasn't doing it. And so other things became introduced, and that ensued for the next, 3, 4 years. I got one DUI. I wasn't really suffering any severe consequences. It was just a party lifestyle. What I had wanted my whole high school career, I was finally able to do without, parental rules, as I put it. And I'm going through relationships, and I don't know how to be in healthy relationships, because I think for a lot of people, developing a healthy relationship is something you develop with your parents in childhood. And I didn't have that, and that was because of my drinking and using. But I think my mom had some other deep-seated issues that were unintentionally cast onto me, like self-esteem and insecurities and comparison things, like I talked about, the inferiority complexes, and these things I've been able to kind of realize now. And so I didn't know how to have healthy relationships. I'm using women. I'm, just, I think I'm a rock star, essentially. It escalates. I turn 21 and I start working in the service industry, which was, that's a whole nother bag of tricks there. What I did is we'd go to work, we'd make cash tips, we'd get off work, we'd go to the bar, and this continued, continued, continued. And then I got another DUI, and it was a super extreme DUI. I blew a 0.302. Honestly, I recalled everything. I didn't think I was that intoxicated. This is like the level of my alcoholism at this point. The officers were even amazed that I could stand or let alone walk, and that wasn't the wake up call yet. It still wasn't. I did a couple weeks in county, and I didn't really take heed to their warnings, nor from friends, or I went to some classes, but I had partying friends. That's all that mattered to me still for at that time. And then I saved, suffered my first serious, like I think wake up call for me. On my 23rd birthday, I had a work meeting early in the morning, but I had an interlock in my car. So I couldn't start my car because I'd been drinking too much the night before. So my roommate's like, "Well, take the motorcycle." I was like, "Okay." So I take the motorcycle and I go to work, and all my coworkers after are like, "Let's go to breakfast. It's your birthday," because all my coworkers love me because I'm the party, have fun guy at work, right? And because that's that connection that I seek, and I want people to think I'm that person. And on the way, or we're at the breakfast place, and I have a couple shots, and they're trying to get me to drink more, and I'm like, I gotta take the bike home. I don't wanna wreck my roommate's bike. Well, on the way home, I wrecked my roommate's bike. I was trying to show off for the person following me, again seeking acceptance and people like me, and that was another thing, because I thought I was inferior to everybody. And I don't remember much. I remember hitting my brakes, and that's the last thing I remember. I woke up in the hospital the next day, and I was in pain, and my mom was crying, and then my girlfriend's crying, and my ex-girlfriend is crying, and I'm like, My first thought is, what are these three women doing in the same room? I was like, that's a weird combination. And my mom's like, you were in an accident. And I was like, no. I gotta get home. My birthday party is tonight. And she's like, no, son, you were hurt bad. And I shattered my leg. I had severe road rash. I knocked out four teeth. Thankfully, I did have a helmet on, but it came off after initial impact. So that helmet saved my life. But as I like continued to tumble, it came off. And so I have some scars to remind me. And so, I'd like to say that that was that moment that was like, okay, boom, wake up call, Kyle. But it wasn't. And in fact, I get released from the hospital and I'm angry that I can't have my birthday party. And, at this time, there's so many of my coworkers are showing up that care about me, and family are coming to see me in the hospital. And, I realized looking back how loved I was then and how much people cared for me. And I just either I didn't see it, or it wasn't enough, or I was seeking relationships that I wanted and not appreciating the ones I had. And so the next day I have a friend bring me alcohol. I'm at my parents' house. Because they didn't want me to go home. They wanted to look after me for a few days. And I had my friend sneak me alcohol in a cup because I was depressed. I had some severe road rash on my face, and I thought I was going to be deformed. And I'm highly insecure and vain. So I was like, I'm going to be ugly. No one's going to love me. And I went into like a depression. And this is where a big transformative moment in my using happened too. I was introduced to Percocet after the accident.
Is that the pain for pain?
Yes,
Okay.
it's a pain narcotic. Generic form is oxycodone, which is it's a powerful painkiller. And being the addictive nature that I already had, once I was given these, it was, oh, let's build a jump even bigger. Like, okay. And so I'm coupling these prescription pills with my alcoholism. I don't really smoke pot anymore. I don't know why. I just kind of grew out of that one, but. The drinking and the pills became it just reached a new level of dependence because the pills you hurt if you don't have them. So I was taking them far past the intended, like, because my leg stopped hurting a month after the accident, but I enjoyed the intoxication of the pills somewhat. I continued to take them, and I manipulated the doctor into continuing to give them to me. And then they cut me off, and I'm taking them on the streets. I was shortly after that, I met a girl. I had just lost my job. I couldn't afford to buy the painkillers. I was detoxing. I was going through withdrawal, and I was hurting. And I met this girl. She introduced me to heroin. I used intravenously for the first time. And immediately, like, it was over. I knew at that moment it was. This was the new thing that I was a slave to. I can put it no better than that. It immediate, just I had met my match,
What is heroin? What
And
does it do to you? Kyle, what's heroin?
so it's similar. It's similar to like the oxycodone, but like multiplied by like 1,000. It is a opiate. There's opioids and opiates, and opioid are synthetic, which is like your oxycodones, your Vicodin, and then there's opiates, which are the narcotic, like heroin and fentanyl is that as well. Essentially, it gives you a feeling. I remember a doctor describing this feeling, and it's pretty accurate. It makes you feel like you just had a long day at work, and you just sat on the couch, and you just, and you feel like you're floating on a cloud. It's a comforting, warm, just relaxing feeling. And if you can imagine that magnified times like a million is how I would describe that feeling. And but it gets to a point where you're constantly searching that feeling, but what you're getting is you're just trying to avoid getting sick because the withdrawal is just awful. It's like an intense flu. Your bones hurt, coupled with many other things. It is not something I wish upon anyone. And they've actually compared it to like people going through chemo treatment, like what they experience after chemo, that just you're drained, you're exhausted, you feel sick, you're just it's similar to that is what I've heard it compared to. And so once that's introduced, in less than 4 months, everything's gone. My house, my car, my friends. I'm spending, $100 to $200 a day. I'm barely like hanging on to the job I have. Everyone's gone. I start sleeping on a friend's couch, and then I lose that job, and I start committing crimes to be able to provide for my habit. I accumulate more charges, and I was sentenced to jail for about 30 days on one particular charge, and I got out and I got high. That very day that I got out, and I had no intention, I had no desire to use. With every fiber of my being, I was like, I'm done. But I got out and I got high. And I remember having that thought, like, what, Kyle, what are you doing? Like, this needs to stop. And so I reached out to a friend of mine who I had known to recover from addiction of heroin, and she turned me to this rehab facility. And I started working a 12-step program. I got a sponsor. I started really doing it for about a month and a half, and I got a girlfriend, and my life was good again. I had a good job. I wasn't sick. I looked good. I felt good. Confidence was restored. And that's what I like had thought the program was designed to do, is to take you out of that pit that I've dug for myself. So I stopped going to as many meetings. I stopped working with my sponsor. I made my girlfriend my higher power, like she's all that mattered, and inevitably that didn't last. And so I did what I knew to do when I was hurt or scared or whatever, and I went and I used again. And so I didn't really go back on heroin. I kind of just did pills for a while, and then some old charges got brought up, and I was looking at some significant prison time, and that scared me. So I started using heroin again, and they actually gave me a break, and they sentenced me to about a year of work furlough, which is where you get to leave every day and go to work and come back. Because the judge didn't know I was screwing up, and she gave me a chance. She's all, I don't want to send you to prison because you seem to be getting things back together. So I'm going to give you this break. But if you screw up, you're getting like the max sentence. Like, this is your last chance. And I was just like, okay, cool. I'm not going to prison. Whatever you say, judge, sure. But I do. I start using again, and about a few months when I'm about to get off probation for those charges, I don't know how I even lasted that long. I am going to meet up with my drug dealer, and I rear end a car. Luckily not fast. It was just at a red light. I let off the brake and I hit the car in front of me, and I'm freaking out because I don't have a license, and I'm actually trying to flee the scene, but it's traffic, so I'm blocked in, and I'm like freaking out, and the cops start pulling up, and I knew that was it. I was like, all right, I'm gonna be in some trouble now. I wasn't high at the moment when that happened, but I did have some pills on me, and I didn't want the cops to find them, so I took them before the cops like started talking to me, and but they saw my past DUI record, so they thought I was intoxicated. And by the time they brought a sobriety expert over to do a field sobriety test, the pills were kicking in,
Oh no.
and so they charged me with driving under the influence of narcotics. This was my third DUI, and in the state of Arizona, we have the most strictest DUI laws in the whole country. For your first aggravated DUI, that was aggravated because I was driving on a suspended, and it was my 30th DUI, it's a mandatory minimum of 2.5 years in prison. And I had that, and I was looking at that, and then I had to go back in front of that judge who had made that deal with me, and she said, "Mr. Cummings, you made a deal with me, and you broke that deal. And so what we're going to do is I'm giving you the 5 years, which was on your other charge, and I will leave it up to prosecution to determine the rest on this DUI." And so, I'm so defeated. I went into prison, and I went into jail, and I was detoxing, and I went into this state of psychosis I had never experienced before. I don't know why in particular. I like to say now it had to do with like a spiritual awakening, but I had detoxed several times in jail, but this was just different. I didn't know what was reality. I came in at 138 pounds. I'm 5'11". I went in at 138 pounds. I dropped down to 125 pounds. I couldn't eat. I couldn't drink water. I thought my dreams were reality, and reality was dreams. I just can't explain the level of just disarray my mind was in. And when I finally cleared from it, I was like, okay, like I started praying and a God that I didn't really know that I believed in at the moment, but I just wanted some relief. And I think that was the beginning of starting. And they came at me at first with about 12 years, sentence. And I was like, this is insane. I've
Twelve
never hurt
years.
anybody. I don't know. Like it was a shocker. And I think it was sort of a tactic they used to kind of scare you. And I ended up signing for 7.5 years. And how they sentenced me, they gave me just, they didn't allege that 5 year. They just sentenced me the max sentence on that DUI, which was 7.5 years. And I got to prison and I'm not prison. I'm not that guy. Whatever image you may, conception you have of prison, that's not something I ever thought I would be a part of. I'm not violent. I'm a people pleasing, like kind, joking guy.
You
Like,
do not
so.
look like the image, I would think.
Right. And so I got there and I was scared. I had to go to a medium custody yard because if you're over 5 years in the state of Arizona, you have to go to medium custody, which, so I'm around guys that have murdered people. I'm around people doing life sentences. And it was scary, but I remember my first night in there and I was praying again and I was recalling the happiest that I had been in the last like decade. And the happiest, like true happiest that I had been in that last decade was those few months that I spent in that rehab and that 12-step recovery program. And so that was it. It was simple. And that's what God said to me is, well, you need to go back to those rooms. And so I was fortunate that they had a small group in there of Narcotics Anonymous. It was very informal. We kind of just met and talked about our problems and but it was nice. It was good to be around people that were trying to go in the same direction as me, you know, not on the yard trying to score drugs or gamble or get in fights or, you know. So I was reclassed after about a year to a minimum custody because that's when I went under 5 years. And at this new facility I went to, they had AA meetings every night. We had volunteers coming in about 4 days a week. People with serious clean time that were really bringing in hope and stuff. And I picked up a sponsor. I started doing the steps. I rigorously did them. And a big transformation in my recovery was when I, and this is what we're talking about, the whole point of what's changed me is when I started sponsoring other men, taking them through the steps. And I remember I was with my sponsor one day and I had my first sponsee and I was like starting to see a change in him. And a sponsee is like similar to like mentoring someone. I'm taking him through the steps and I'm telling my sponsor, like, man, this feels so cool. Like he's coming to me for help and I'm able to give him good guidance and I can see him changing. And he said to me so nonchalantly, he's like, yeah, dude, you have purpose today, and walked away. And I remember thinking, not what I said, but for the podcast, I was like, screw you, dude. Like I've had purpose. And then I sat in my bed that night and I was thinking, I was like, you know what, Kyle, you haven't. Whatever purpose you had before was always self-motivated, selfish, inconsiderate because you were insecure. You never had enough. And every relationship you've ever been in was selfish, whether friends, family, brothers, whatever. And that's when this shift happened. And so it was finding that purpose, but more importantly, the purpose beyond myself. That was the shift that really happened. And so for the next 4.5 years, because it was about 6 months into that lower custody yard, I dedicated my life to 12-step fellowship and helping as many men as I could in that prison. I was fortunate. I probably sponsored 100 men, not all of them completed. I was able to speak at orientation when the new prisoners would show up. I convinced staff to let me go up there and plant little seeds of hope and just tell them a quick 5 minute of my story and encourage them to come to meetings. I orchestrated with volunteers like Jeopardy events and stuff with the AA fellowship. Like it was really cool. And I met some amazing men in there and I'm still friends with them today. And my life just changed. People started coming back in my life. I stopped feeling insecure. I'm healthy because, you know, it isn't just the 12 steps. Obviously, it's for me, it's connecting spiritually and also like physically, mind, body, soul, you know. And I started working out. I feel better. I gain confidence. I start to realize my value because I see my value. I look at my past as I'm helping these men. I look at my past now as my greatest asset because even all that, I don't carry shame and guilt for all the stuff that I did. Because I did some pretty like awful things, you know? But when I use those tools and those things of my past to help another man come out of that same stuff, it becomes valuable. And so I can draw from my past no longer the guilt and remorse. I can draw on that and look at it as this is my greatest asset because I use it to help save other men.
Oh, I see. So,
And
like,
so,
rather than the shame or the guilt and regret, you feel that you went through that experience to turn around and help others in it. Is that how you?
absolutely.
Okay. Keep going,
Yeah.
Kyle. I'm sorry.
Because I don't, because a lot of us addicts and alcoholics or people in general, it's not just limited to us. If we've done harmful things in the past, that can carry a heavy burden on us. Like, oh, I'm a terrible person. I can't believe I hurt so and so or did that or upset that, and that one of the hardest things for us, that I've experienced in recovery with addicts and alcoholics is trying to forgive ourselves, And so I was able to forgive myself because, again, like I said, using my past to save someone else's life is it's an asset. Even if it was terrible things, I don't associate it with terribleness. I associate it as gratitude because I can use it to help others. Because when a man connects with me, because he's like, oh man, I went through that too, and you're doing good, then it gives him hope, right?
Yeah, and that's why. That's why I didn't ask for more information on you, man. When I saw that on that email, there's so many people looking for hope. And when you're describing about you went through what you did to turn around and give others hope that are in a similar situation, Kyle, I'm not so sure it gets much better than that, does it? That's not much of a higher purpose than that, is there?
For sure. And that and what's even better is as my recovery program grew, my faith program grew, I began to see God calling me to him, and I connected with him and knowing that what his purpose for me is, how it lines up with what my purpose is of what I'm doing is amazing. It's been wild. I've been fortunate. I've been published in, I've written some articles that have been published nationally in recovery magazines. Of course, anonymously, because in the program we stay anonymous. And to know that people are reading things I've written about my story in another country and potentially giving them hope is amazing. And things were still tough. My mother was really hands off when I was in prison, kind of tough love type, and a lot of my family was coming back, healthy relationships, learning how to give and not what I'm getting out of people. And but about 8 months until my release from prison, I found out my mom had stage 4 lung cancer,
Oh.
and she reached out to me. We would write letters like every few months just to check in. But I caused that woman a lot of pain, to see her son just build up to just crush her again and again. And so we reached out. We started talking on the phone again, and her health is diminishing quickly. And this is about right towards the end of COVID. We were lifting COVID protocols at the prison because we weren't allowed to have like visits for a long time. And she's all, I want to come see you. She hadn't visited me my entire, 5 and a half almost years in prison. And I was like, well, of course, I want to see you too. And she got to come, and she was very frail, and she was in a wheelchair. And but she saw her son, for the first time, is what I say. She had seen her son, but I was hidden behind the drugs and the alcohol. And so she immediately saw it. My mom always knew when I was on drugs or when I was drinking or when I wasn't, because she'd always tell me the light's on in your eyes or it's not. And so she immediately saw the light on, and she could just see I was in the best shape, or just everything that she just, I saw it on her face right away. And so we got to sit there and talk, and I had the joy of sharing with her. Like, I have this folder I keep. It's called Why I Do It. And it's letters from men I've sponsored or things I'm really proud of in my recovery. And I got to read her letters of some of the men, lives that I've
Oh,
changed. And
wow.
it was really emotional, and it was really like heartfelt. And I got to it was tough because as my cousin was wheeling her to the door and it's closing, it dawned on me, I knew it, but I didn't really know it. Like, this is the last time I'm going to see my mother alive.
Oh,
And
Kyle, man.
she, they wheeled her out, and it was very emotional. I still get teared up a lot when I tell this part of the story, but it's a really testament to where I am spiritually and because of the program, because in that moment I wasn't mad. I wasn't like, this isn't fair. Like, Kyle, why weren't you smarter? Why you could have been out there spending time with your mother before she died. None of that was in my head. What was in my head is that I was just so grateful to God that I was able to say goodbye. Because I witnessed so many people during that time lose family members, and there was no visits, and they didn't get to say goodbye. And not only did I get to say goodbye, but my mom got to see her son, the best that she's ever seen him. And what I think about in that moment is I was able to let her pass, knowing finally she could stop worrying about her son. Because that's all I did for that woman, she just worried because she loved me so much, and we butted heads because she just cared. And so that was tough. And then she passed, and I had scheduled to meet with a sponsee shortly after that visit because I knew it was going to be really emotional. And when I sat down, he brought a card from all the men in the rooms out on our prison yard, and it was signed from them, telling me how much they love me and that they're here for me. And that was that fellowship, that connection
Oh,
I'd
Kyle, man, that's
finally,
awesome.
finally been seeking, I found it. And, I got out. I went to a meeting my first night. I started working with sponsees. I do everything I did in prison. The only thing that's changed is my geography. It's discipline. It's not, oh, I'm too busy, I can't go to a meeting. It's not, oh, I'm really tired, sponsee, I'm sorry, I can't talk to you right now. No, I keep doing what I'm doing because it's been working, and I've grown my faith, and today my life's amazing. I work in the field of recovery, which I can't confuse with my recovery because it is different. It has its own challenges, but to know that I'm working in a field, that's my purpose as well as my passion. It's awesome. It's challenging still, just like a work day would be, because some guys don't want it, and that's the unfortunate truth. We get guys come in and they don't want it. They're not ready. I think the statistic recently I heard, every 5 minutes someone dies from fentanyl in the United States. And we're trying to build an army against that, is how I like to put it. And
If you're a family member or friend, what can you do? What I mean, I've never had an addiction to a drug, and the reason I say that, I guess we all have different kinds of, and you're gonna have to coach me through this. I've never had an addiction to a drug, but I've had other things that got a hold on me that shouldn't have.
Of course.
That's why I don't feel that anyone can judge someone else for whatever issue they have, because we all have some issue here. But if you have a family member or friend that's struggling from a drug addiction, what can you do?
We have come leaps and bounds in this area in the United States. So many states work with insurance now, even like access, the minimal insurance that anyone can get, homeless or low to no income, or even if you have a great paying job and you have a great insurance, like these will pay for your treatment. And there are so many facilities out there. It's just being willing to go and do it. And it's as simple as calling up a detox center that can position you into like maybe you usually want to clear out for a little bit. You go through detox. You make sure you don't have like severe symptoms of withdrawal, like dying, because you can die sometimes from withdrawal, depending on if it's alcoholism or different drugs carry different withdrawals. And then they can get you into residential treatment centers, or they can do outpatient, or they can point you in the direction. There's always 12-step meetings everywhere. There's apps you can get. You can look it up online, whether it's NA, AA. And if drugs aren't your thing, it could be gambling. There's gambling, there's sex addiction, there's overeaters. I'm a huge advocate for the 12-step process. And, just asking for help is the big part. For so long, I thought my pride would get in the way, like, I can do this. I'll just try it this way, or maybe if I just drink wine instead of beer, or just trying to like make it work somehow. But finally being like, I can't, I can't do this. I've lost, right? And so reaching out for help and just knowing that it is there. And for families of, if they have loved ones that are suffering, and there's Parents of Addicted Loved Ones is a charity that we have in Arizona. I think it is national, and they can give you resources, and it's everywhere. There's, because of this fentanyl and the way this epidemic of these drugs and all this, like, there is a lot of help available for people. It's just a matter of reaching out and getting
So I'm going to ask a couple more questions, although I'd love to ask 50 because I
it.
was listening to your story and it's terrific. You did a great job, and I want to point this out so that everyone recognizes it. You did a wonderful job at starting in a certain place and you end in the same place. So I'm going to restate it, and if I miss the point, please tell me. You spent a lot of your life looking for a connection that you couldn't quite find that satisfied you. And then what you said a while ago is then you found your connection, and your connection was helping and serving others that had been through a similar situation. And that is where your purpose was found. Am I saying that right?
Precisely, because I can, what I'm discovering with these men that I work with is I can remove the drugs and alcohol. There's underlying issues that we really need to address. That's the problem. Because someone who's a week sober is just as sober as I am at 6 years. I just celebrated 6 years 2 weeks ago.
Congratulations.
I am no more sober than that person. But what I've been able to do is gain tools and connection and purpose. So what I try and do at my facility is, you can remove the drugs and alcohol. You can even work on some of these issues. But if you kick a man out the door with no direction, drive, or purpose, then what is he going to do? He's going to root back to what he knows and what he's been familiar with for decades for some men. So I think that was what worked for me. Everyone's road's a little bit different, but I finding a purpose and being connected, that was the huge part.
I said I was going to ask two more questions, and I got three more lining up here. So when you help somebody for the first time out, because I would like some of us may have only one brief interaction. That's the only chance we're going to have with someone that might be struggling. And if we don't get it just right, we might lose the opportunity. What is your first interaction like with someone that might be that's struggling with an addiction? You ask them a certain question to engage them. You mentioned finding a purpose. What do you do?
So, for me, my best tool is my experience. I can usually come to their level and say, "Hey, man, dude, if someone's on the street corner, I was there, dude. I know what you're going through. I have similar experience." Like, but for someone that maybe doesn't have that experience, just recognition. Hey, how are you?
Oh, okay.
And even if they don't want the help, maybe just planting that little seed, like, "Hey, man, if you ever do want to consider stopping this way of living, or if you think it is a problem, I'm not saying it is, but if you do, like, there's help out there." And they may not get it then, and they may not want it then, and they may just be like, "Ah, screw you." But just planting that little seed, they'll never be the same. It will always be in the back of their head after that of, "Well, maybe there is something wrong, or maybe I do need help."
Or maybe somebody cares for you too. Is that
For
how you?
sure.
So I do have two more. One I want to point out is one thing that really stood out to me, and there was like 15 things, but one was when your mom visited. I got to go slow on this because I get a lump in my throat here, but I don't know how common it is that we look at situations like that and don't feel guilt or regret, or you just were grateful that you had that time. I know a fair amount of people that would have felt shame or not wanted to see him or would have been embarrassed or would have felt, but you felt
gratitude. How? That's not common. I don't think it's common. Where did you learn that from? Where did that come from?
So something my sponsor once told me is that whenever we're upset, it's because we lack perspective. And so in that moment, I don't know why I was flooded with it. I was flooded with perspective because again, I didn't think about what I wasn't getting. I was thinking about what I was getting and how my friend, one of my best friends in prison, he lost his father in prison about a year before that, and he didn't get to say goodbye. He found out in a phone call, and that was it. And I don't know why I can't explain in that particular moment, because that's probably something I normally would have done, was think about why couldn't I have done this different or that different. But I think as I dissected that later, a couple weeks after, I thought about how there's nothing more in that moment that I could have wanted more than to give my mom the knowledge that her son's okay. That's all she ever wanted. And I never gave that to her. And so like that, I don't know if it's the monologue I've created in my head or whatever, but that's that piece that I found, was to know, Mom, I'm okay. You can pass. You don't have to worry about your youngest son anymore. And that's where that gratitude came from as well, because so many people I know, their parents don't get to see them get sober. They die while their children are of an active addiction. And that was another perspective that I had that I was able to gain. It's like, Mom, this is me. This is the son you raised. I was just gone for a while in the muck and the misery. So,
Yeah, I learned something, learned many things from you today. I want to be like that. I want to be, because even when you could have thought about yourself, at that moment you thought about her and the memory you're leaving, the relationship, being grateful for the time. That's a perspective that I want. I want, and I think we all should have is, man, just a powerful statement. Yeah, that's a beautiful and a powerful statement to put that. Oh, thank you.
My pleasure.
So if anybody were to reach out to you, I don't know if you want that, or if somebody ha I don't if exactly where you're working now, or if there's any way they can get in touch with. Do you want somebody to get in touch with you? If so, how? That was kind of a
Absolutely.
ridiculous
Yeah.
question to ask you, but.
So they can email me anytime. And I'd be happy to, I'm in Arizona, but there's a network million strong in the 12-Step Fellowship. And even if that's not your cup of tea, there's so much around, and I'd be happy to help with any resources that I could. But my email is recoverykyle32@gmail.com.
Okay.
And so feel free to email me anytime. And or if you have concerns of a friend who's using or maybe going down that road, or any way that I can be of service. That's my mission today. It's not limited to 12-step recovery. I like to just volunteer and where I can. I still suffer from selfishness at times, but who doesn't? But primarily I wake up in the morning and I ask for my scales to be tipped, giving and taking. Or wait, I don't know which, which way I'm talking about. The giving always has to far outweigh the take. And what I found is my life is so much more remarkable because of that. I feel really blessed today.
And that was a perfect way to end it. This was a wonderful podcast episode, except for one thing. I asked a ridiculous question on, do you want people to get in touch
No.
with
Excellent. It was great.
you? But Kyle, thank you so much. It's been terrific. I'm grateful for the time you spent with us.
Well, it's been a pleasure, and I thank you for having me. And yeah, anyone, feel free to email me anytime.
Okay, thank you.